The meeting will come to order. Representative Morrow, would you like to approve the minutes?
I move approval of the minutes.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Good morning, Chair.
Good morning.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I think we're ready to rock. Okay. At this time, I'll move that House File 484 be referred to pass and to be referred to taxes, where House File 568 already is. We are, Representative Kuhn and I have got a hearing next week, Monday night, together in taxes, and I don't know why 568 House File that I have is skipping this important committee. So we're going to be hearing both bills together, and they both are very, very, very related. Representative Kuhn has House File 484 in front of you, and I have House File 568. If you look at both the bills, they're identical. Representative Kuhn's has to do with capital credits for land on a quarter section, and mine has to do with capital credits with assets. And that's basically the only difference. Right now, I believe there is probably 125 farmers statewide that may qualify for Representative Kuhn's bill. On my behalf, there may be as many as five. Representative Tremba, you and I have a couple farmers I know in our district that are renting a dairy barn. So they would, that same concept would fall along with Representative Kuhn's idea. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Representative Kuhn. Do you have a couple words you want to say beforehand?
Representative Kuhn.
Madam Chair, I also have an amendment that I would like moved to get the bill into the shape I would like it.
Okay.
It's the H-484-A1 amendment.
With that said, we will move that if the bill ever comes back, or at least what's on tape, that amendment also would apply to 568 House File.
I'll move the 484-A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Do you want to tell me a little bit about the amendment before we proceed?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. What the amendment does is really pretty simple, and it has to do with cost savings and fairness as far as implementing the program. What it says is that these tax credits would be applicable to any agreements made after December 1, 2006. In other words, any rental agreements before that time, the landowners, or as far as that goes, beginning farmer, wouldn't be able to apply for tax credits for that past period. So it just starts it just sets up a beginning date.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions or comments on the amendment? If not, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Representative Kuhn.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. What this does is set up a tax credit for landowners who are willing to rent their land to a beginning farmer. And in my bill, it states that it has to be more than 10 acres. The beginning farmer would have to be a livestock or a crop producer. It's a 10% investment credit for cash rent, and a 15% investment credit for share rent, whatever the net value of the share would be. There's also a credit for the beginning farmer for him or herself, and that would be up for the cost of enrolling in a farm management program, and that would be up to $500. Each of these credits are good for can be applied for up to 3 years, and they're non-refundable credits. The beginning farmer would be a farmer or livestock producer who has entered farming or livestock production within the last 7 years. That just sets up the definition, but as I said, the amendment wouldn't allow to go back and get the credits for any time in the past. The farm operation has to be inside the Minnesota borders, of course, and the beginning farmer can't be related by blood or marriage to the landowner. Also, the beginning farmer can't have a net worth of more than $200,000, and that would include in holdings by a spouse or dependent. And the beginning farmer must provide the majority of the day-to-day physical labor and management. And the beginning farmer needs to demonstrate a knowledge in farming or livestock production. We want these beginning farmers to succeed, of course. And then they have to submit earning statements that would show a profitability of the operation.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Do you have any testifiers? Or Representative Heidrich, would you like to speak first?
In your packet, you will have a fiscal analysis there for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And the explanation of the bill there on the second paragraph there, it says the beginning farmer incentive credit is allowed to an owner of agricultural land, and it should say, and assets in, and then we got them both covered. With that, Mr. Peterson has a few words to say as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and here to speak on behalf of House File 484 and House File 568, and I appreciate the work that all the committee members do. This is an important issue for anybody involved in agriculture, because bottom line, you know, and I look at some of the numbers, in 1997, the average age of a farmer was 51. In 2002, they do the five-year statistics for the USDA, it jumped to 53, and the USDA has been telling us that it could be as high as 56 or 57 in 2007, so it's been really increasing. And the USDA statistics also say that 6% of our nation's farmers, only 6%, are under 35 years of age. So that, you know, kind of lays out some of the problem. I also wanted to say that this is a start, that this bill is something that a lot of you ask us, what can we do to help beginning farmers? And this bills are kind of modeled after a Nebraska farm law that I provided the committee some of the information on the Nebraska law. And I just want to talk very briefly about that. I visited with the Nebraska Department of Agriculture and Nebraska Farmers Union about the bill. And the bottom line is the Nebraska state employee I talked to, she's very proud of the program, and she said that people have entered the program because of this bill, and that has been very helpful in Nebraska. Some of the numbers from Nebraska is about 80 farms have entered Nebraska, have entered farming in about 6 years the program has been active. So it's not a huge number. If you look at 80 divided by 6, and I'm a liberal arts guy, so somebody could do that math for me. But if you do the look at the numbers, too, and I interesting on the fiscal note as this bill goes forward, but Nebraska has about 50,000 farms. Minnesota has 79,000 farms. And they tell me it costs them $50,000 a year to run the program and what they pay out in tax credits on those farms. So I think our fiscal note's a little high, and I don't know if they looked at that or not, but that's important. So the average credit in Nebraska is about $1,400. It's been as high as $2,400. The program receives about 200 requests a year. So just in general, in closing, Madam Chair and committee members, I think that this definitely would be a help and would help Minnesota, too, in getting some young people into farming. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have another testifier?
Madam Chairman, my name is Paul Sobosinski. Appreciate the opportunity to testify here today on behalf of the Land Stewardship Project. We started working on this concept in terms of this type of legislation last year. We worked with the former chair of the committee, Greg Davids, worked with both sides. It was a bipartisan effort. We actually had this language included in the tax bill, and as you know, the tax bill on the House side blew up last year, basically. So what I'd like to do is just, in general, I want to say I support both these bills going forward. The hall piece that I think it's important to look at is that as we look at agriculture, it's not only wanting to encourage more livestock development across the countryside, but it's also about people, that we need to have young people involved in rural communities. For example, part of my life, besides working for the Land Stewardship Project, I also farm and raise livestock. And I just want to share, my wife Candy and I have four children, and my wife's been a teacher for about 30 years at St. Anne's Catholic School in Wabasso. And why that's been important, or at least want to relate the story, is that for the last 30 years, we've had about 100 students in that school. And part of the reason for that is in our community of Wabasso, we have other development besides agriculture, but we have some other business that we've brought to the community. But we've also had a young generation of folks that had children that have been supporting the school. And so when we think about community and we look at neighboring communities, what's happening in so much of our part of our rural part of our state is we're not keeping enough young people. In order to have a viable community, it takes a mixture of young, old, middle age. And so, and one of the natural things that happens in terms of a community, or in terms of farms, is relatives normally help, you know, other relatives get started in farming. This bill is designed to, for those situations where maybe a relative doesn't exist, to provide a tool. What we like to call a tool, that's why the benefit goes to the landowner who would rent the land to a beginning farmer, to open that door so that young farmer has a chance. Another piece I'd like to point out is that the Nebraska bill was signed then by Governor Johans, who's now our current Secretary of Agriculture. A number of pieces that have been done by USDA in this area indicates that one of the things that we're going to help beginning farmers, it's just not about programs, lower interest rates, but it's also about creating access. And that also, another key part of this bill is like share rent. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of both these bills.
You're welcome. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to commend the authors and the testifiers for I think bringing forth some needed legislation. We certainly need to do things to encourage young people to get into or to stay in farming. You know, I knew it was a good bill, and then I realized that I was a co-author and realized how much better it was. Even. But you know, cost is always a concern. I know there are a lot of, you know, tax credits out there, and I know we're a policy committee, but I'd still like to know what is the fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman, I think you have a copy of that fiscal note.
Right. It's in front of you.
Is I think in 2008 it's estimated at what, $975,000? Is that correct?
Yeah.
And in 2009 it increases. But what I'd like to point out that when the fiscal note was done last year, you have, in terms of the Representative Coonan's bill, you have the same bill that was offered and the amendment that was put forward that had a fiscal note that was roughly between a third and half of this amount. And the reason for the difference that we understand, and that's why Representative Coonan offered the amendment that he did previously, is this year the Department of Revenue assumed that we're going backwards. And Representative Coonan's amendment makes clear that, in fact, it's starting, you know, this year in the year of adoption. So we believe that based upon that, that amendment goes forward, that a new fiscal note will be done that will probably represent somewhere in the neighborhood. And this is my layman's term, but, you know, less than half of the amount.
Representative Erdahl, we can get that for you.
Okay.
This is the policy committee, so
right.
I didn't put it in all the folders, but we can get it for you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one other point. We don't have a copy of that, so that's why the chair was...
Madam Chair, we have a... Mr. Peterson has something to say to that question.
Madam Chair, members, too, I was looking at the fiscal note, and they assume, I think, 375 people would use that credit, which I think, again, Minnesota has 79,000 farmers, Nebraska has 50,000, and the most participants, number of owners receiving tax credits, the high has been 46. And so they're assuming, which is great, that this program would be wildly successful compared to the Nebraska. And Nebraska also has a lower threshold, but they've raised up to what these bills would be. So I do take a little exception with that fiscal note, too. So, but it would be great if it was that way. Thank you.
With that said, Madam Chair, it would be the best-case scenario if that would happen.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And... as you're aware, negotiating with fiscal notes is, you know, fair game, and I spent some time on a couple of bills yesterday doing that. Representative Heidkirchen, your bill is in taxes now? Okay, well, you were questioning whether such an important bill should have been heard here first. I think because of its importance, it went directly to taxes.
Are there any other questions? Comments? Representative Heidrichen?
Madam Chair, thank you. And again, this is Minnesota has some of the other states have some very good beginning farm programs going forth. And this is just a small token. But we need to do something. We need to get the young farmers started in some way. Generally, if you're a very large farmer, the banks and the credit unions and everybody else is there to help you. But there is very, very little help for the little guy that wants to get started. And I think this is very important for them. Thank you.
Representative Poonen.
Madam Chair, thank you. And thank you to the committee also for hearing this bill. And as Representative Heidrichen mentioned, that this is important to keep farmers on the land and to get new farmers started. If you'll note that, though, I would like to point out that this bill applies to young farmers that are not related to the landowners. And I think that there needs to be some emphasis there to open up the possibility to a larger number of people to actually have an opportunity to farm. A lot of times you'll see that nowadays that most new farmers actually have parents who have farmed and they get started in that way. I know I've had some people ask me, well, aren't you kind of leaving out the families in this case? And the truth of the matter is there is some benefit for some families in some case already, in that if the retiring farmers, the parents move off the land and their children or grandchildren move on to the farm and begin farming, that the homestead credit can be extended in that case. So there is some help for those some of those families in those cases, and we didn't want to necessarily double up there either. But anyway, thanks again for hearing the bill, and just ask for your support.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Heidrichen, would you like to renew your motion?
And I'll make a motion that we refer Bill House File 44 to be sent out to taxes, where already House File 568 is. And if House File 568 comes back, Madam Chair, I hope you pass it on where Representative Coonan's bill may be at that time. But they're both being heard Monday in taxes. With that, we renew my motion that to pass House File 484 as amended.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Representative Olin. Welcome to the committee. Representative Faust, would you like to move the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1433 be passed and move to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and Representative Faust. Today's bill basically is a department agency bill from Department of Agriculture. What it does is allows for elk and wolf damage to continue as it has in the past, but sets a minimum and a maximum. By way of background, before I turn it over to Gary Friesel, who's with me, there's never been anything filed under a $100 minimum, and $20,000 max has never been hit. It came up that big once, but it ended up being an insurance claim, and there wasn't even a claim at all that was handled in that case. There were four claims filed on the Elks last year. The average of those four was 1,578, which is considerably under the 20,000 and obviously over the 100 minimum. The highest amount per year that's ever been done in this field combined for these, the deer, or for the elk and the wolf, was $91,000 and some odd dollars. It's never hit the $100,000 max. So basically what the bill does is ask for a $100 minimum, a $20,000 maximum per claim on both the wolf and the elk, and $100,000 per year for the for both years of the biennium. And I'll turn it over to Gary Friesel if he has any other comments.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Gere Friesel. I'm the director of the Plant Protection Division. I think Representative Olin has done a great job summarizing the bill. The the minimum and maximum in the wolf claim makes that uniform with the elk claim portion, so the two are now the same. So I think that's helpful. We did get supplemental funding last year to bring the appropriation up to $100,000, and so I think we're in pretty good shape financially. And as Representative Olin pointed out, we've never had claims above that, so we think this is a good place to be.
Are there any questions? Representative Fowles?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is on the wording here. It looks to me like if somebody would lose 10 animals that are each worth less than $100, they could not file a claim. Is that right?
Representative Olin?
In the past, they've allowed claims individually on animals. And there haven't been any filed under 100 ever. So I don't think as far as under 100 that it'll happen. Claims have always been over 100.
Okay, but I mean, if a sheep, for example, is probably worth less than $100, especially if it gets up in age a little bit. And if somebody had 10 of those that were all killed by one wolf, according to the wording here, they would not be able to file a claim. And if that's...
That would be correct.
Okay.
It hasn't occurred, but that is the wording that does exist.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? Comments? If not, would you... Representative
Fowles? I renew the motion to pass House File 1433 and move it to the General Register.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is passed.
Thank you.
Representative Doty.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Doty.
Thank you. I'm here to move that we would pass House File 878 and refer it to, hopefully, the consent calendar. So I will make that motion.
Do you have any amendments?
I have an author's amendment, which should be coded A070105. And if you will look at that, it's simply, instead of only the Commissioner of Agriculture, the bill would now include Commissioner of Natural Resources and of Health. The reason for adding those two departments, very simply, there are many diseases that work back and forth, cattle to deer herds, for example, and everyone is aware of the possibility of avian flu coming from the agriculture sector and maybe getting transmitted to humans, so those seem like other good additions to that committee.
Are there any?
So I would move the adoption of that amendment.
Are there any? Representative Heidepin?
Okay, I think he's got the amendment, and I'll second. Well, but the question I have is it's more of a comment, and I hadn't realized that. I know a number of years ago, Representative Finstead and Representative Tremba, Representative Junkie, remember we had the discussion when the Animal Board of Health was under the guise of the Department of Agriculture, and they separated a number of years ago to go on their own merry way. And apparently it was our oversight of not adding the Commissioner of Agriculture to that board. And I think that's all this is doing, and I think it's good. But it should have been done then. Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments? If not, all those in favor of the amendment?
Aye.
Opposed? Continue. Do you have a testifier? Or?
Yes.
Madam Chairman, Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health of the State Veterinarian. This is an agency bill that we put forward. We think it just makes sense for the Commissioner of Agriculture to be part of our board. And I'll just explain the board a little bit. It won't take up a lot of time, but our board is by statute a five-member citizen board. Two of those people are veterinarians, and three of them are livestock producers. Right now we have, in the livestock industry, we have somebody representing the swine industry, somebody representing the cattle industry, and somebody representing the poultry industry. That board meets quarterly and sets direction for the Board of Animal Health. Currently, there are two non-voting consultants to the board. One was added recently. That is the director of the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. That lab is crucial to our operations. The other is the dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine. So this would add the Commissioner of Agriculture and, with the amendment, the Commissioners of DNR and Health to our board and as non-voting consultants. And what I would say is this only makes sense. Those people are always at our board meetings. They are participants, and I agree with Representative Doty that we need their input as we're working together. So,
thank you. Are there any questions? Comments? If not, would you like to renew your motion?
Madam Chair, I move that we pass House File 878 as amended and refer it to the consent calendar.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill has passed. Thank you. Welcome, Representative Schumper.
Morning, Madam Chair. Morning, members. You should have before you House File 1047.
Representative Faust, would you like to move the...
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1047 be passed and move to the Finance Committee.
Madam Chair, I also have an author's amendment to get the bill in a little different shape.
Okay.
That's Amendment 8. It's coded A070052.
Representative Faust, do you
want to
move the amendment?
I sure will. I'll move the passage of House of Amendment A07-0052.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, this is a bill brought to me by the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine, and I have with me Dr. John King, who's the Executive Director, and Dr. Meg Blatley, who's also a member of the Board of Veterinary Medicine. They have several items that they need reworked here in statute, and I assume you all have the House Research Summary dealing with some of the aspects. First of all, they're creating this program for the assessment of veterinarian education equivalents. It's the second process for the evaluation of veterinarian education by foreign-trained veterinarians. And this is a program used in 22 other licensing jurisdictions in the United States. Secondly, it allows the board to collect fees for verifications of licensure and continuing education, which is part of the governor's budget. Third, it deals with the issue of equine teeth floating, and basically it eliminates a grandfathering clause that was established some years ago, has no impact on people who are already met requirements for equine teeth floating. Fourth, it allows European veterinarians or veterinarians from Europe to be certified under a special licensure program by the University of Minnesota Veterinary and Medical Center. Fifth, it eliminates some requirements for services of board orders by certified U.S. mails and allows them to use the standard type of notification that attorneys use here in Minnesota. And finally, it modifies and clarifies some veterinarian dispensing and prescription language to be consistent with the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy and FDA language. I thought I would start out, Madam Chair, by having Dr. King explain a little the program for the assessment of veterinarian education.
Thank you. Can you state your name for the committee, please?
Madam Chair and Committee, I'm Dr. John King. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine. As Representative Schumper said, there are several items here that would that are included in this bill that would change the veterinary statutes, one of which is acceptance of it's called the PAVE program. It's a national evaluation process for foreign-trained graduates. It currently, there's only one national process that's accepted in Minnesota for evaluation of educational equivalency of foreign-trained graduates, and that's called the ECFVG, another acronym. And this PAVE program has been around for 6+ years. It's accepted in 20 states, 2 U.S. territories, and also in Utah. They will license individuals that have a PAVE certificate or have gone through the program as long as they've been licensed in another jurisdiction. The board has done due diligence and research in this, feel that they are comparable programs and that they protect the public in evaluating the educational equivalency of foreign trained graduates. The fee collection is estimated to generate approximately $5,000. These would not be fees or taxes directly to citizens of Minnesota, nor necessarily the veterinary community. It would just allow the board to capture fees when individuals that are licensed in Minnesota would seek licensure in another state. The board is required to send a license verification. It would be a $25 fee. Also, it would collect $50 from sponsors of continuing education, Pfizer, Mariel, some of the sponsors, CE sponsors that put on continuing education events. And again, it's just to capture time and resources spent by the board to evaluate this. The European Board Certification of Veterinarians and the University of Minnesota Veterinary Medical Center. Prior to 2004, the clinicians at the University of Minnesota that were working on animals owned by the public were not required to be licensed in Minnesota. The University of Minnesota Veterinary Medical Center came forward and requested that some type of special licensure be created so that their clinicians are accountable and have some kind of, there is some kind of process if there are citizens Minnesota that are unhappy with the services, that those clinicians can be held accountable. Prior to that, there was no mechanism for investigating or disciplining or doing anything to clinicians at the University of Minnesota. When this law was written in 2004, it did not include, it included individuals could get licensed if they were American board certified in a specialty area. Did not anticipate European board certification. The university has requested that also recognize European board certification so they can open their pool of applicants for faculty. These individuals that are European board certified have already graduated from a veterinary school, have a veterinary degree, and gone to an advanced training to become board certified or specialist in that area. It will also include some kind of supervision for individuals that are practicing in a veterinary medical center that would have a temporary license. The other things in here, the certified U.S. mail is just a business, allowing us to do business more efficiently. And the dispensing stuff is just so we're consistent with Board of Pharmacy, Minnesota Board of Pharmacy and USDA. And the grandfathering clause of the tooth floater would not according to Senate Research and the Attorney General's Office, would not impact any individuals that have already met the requirements to float equine teeth in Minnesota that are not licensed veterinarians and not working for veterinarians. I'm available for any questions, as is Dr. Glatley.
Are there any questions? Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just interested in the teeth floating services. Have there been problems with those who have not been licensed veterinarians that have been providing these services? I don't know if there's any documented cases of problems that have occurred.
Madam Chair, Representative Eakin, this came up in 2005. Prior to that, and it always has been interpreted by the Attorney General's Office that floating equine teeth is a component of the practice of veterinary medicine as defined in statutes. There has been instances where non-licensed individuals have been performing medical services floating horses' teeth, and there have been injuries by those individuals. In 2005, a bill came forward that provided for individuals that are non-veterinarians, non-employees of veterinarians, and individuals that don't own the horses or are not employed by someone that owns the horses, to allow them to float equine teeth in Minnesota. There was two components to it. One was a grandfathering clause. The bill that came forward was written for a specific constituent of legislators, and that was what the grandfathering clause allowed that individual to do. There's also provisions now currently that would require non-veterinarians to receive some kind of training prior to floating teeth for the reasons of ensuring some kind of competency, entry-level training, and protection of the public.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Shumper, can we anticipate then that these veterinarians will be charging a fee to supervise the teeth floaters?
There's, Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, there is currently one individual that is a non-veterinarian that is floating teeth in Minnesota that has met the criteria of the current statute. Not to my knowledge, there is not any fee exchange between the veterinarian that has agreed to provide indirect supervision to that individual. So there's no money exchange that I know of, and nor have I heard of any fees or cost to the non-veterinarian teeth floater. The reason for having some kind of supervision, Representative Erdahl, is to make sure that that individual continues to be competent and that there is some oversight and accountability of the practice of that individual.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I'm the only person here that doesn't have a clue what equine teeth floating is, but I've been involved with agriculture for 35 years, and it sounds to me more like some kind of sporting event than something a veterinarian would do. So if you would please explain to me what exactly we do when we're floating teeth and what the purpose is and why it's such an important thing.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shumper.
Representative Faust, up till about 2 months ago, even though I've milked cows for 50 years, I didn't know what teeth floating for equines was either. It's dentistry. And as I've had it explained to me, and Dr. King can explain more, people take a file and file horses' teeth or something like that. So, Dr. King, do you want
to? Madam Chair, Representative Faust. I would anticipate that if you didn't know what equine teeth floating is, you're going to probably be on the fast track to learning in the next few months. Equine teeth are different from yours and mine, where they're continuously growing, and their jaw is not set as such that the teeth oppositely oppose, so there are sharp enamel points that develop on the teeth. It is the process of taking typically a carbide tip file, putting it in the horse's mouth, and removing those sharp points that cause injury to the horse's mouth, and also other abnormalities, ramps, hooks, and that. Floating is a old term for leveling, and that's the process of floating a horse's teeth. It has nothing to do with sports or water. It's about leveling the horse's teeth to make them so they're not in pain and are better able to use their food and use the bit.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it isn't like a cosmetic thing to make the horse prettier or anything like that, but it actually it extends the life of the horse and gives them a better quality of life and that type of thing.
Madam Chair, Representative Faust, it is not a cosmetic thing by any stretch of the imagination. It's a medical procedure, and it's for the betterment of the animal.
Representative Heiderkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On Section 9, talking about the subject we're talking about right now, I have Representative Coonan up, following him, and he did carry legislation to have this done last year, to eliminate it at this time. I have a very difficult time, so I'm going to make a motion at this time that we keep the language 4.26, 4.29, not omit it, but to keep it as it is, because I just talked to Representative Coonan, and he's got another bill coming forth that's even going to strengthen this. So at this time, I'd like to make that motion that we keep the language as is in 4.26, 7, 8, and 9.
Any discussion on the amendment? Representative.
Madam Chair, could Dr. King respond to that?
Madam Chair, Representative, members of the committee, the reason for eliminating of this grandfathering clause is in no way, shape, or form designed to be punitive by the Board of Veterinary Medicine, or the motivation is simply this. After the bill was passed and went into effect in 2005, and the constituent for whom the bill was written had met the requirements, the Board of Veterinary Medicine received calls from unidentified individuals that assuming were equine teeth floaters that indicated that they wanted to be grandfathered in and able to do this. When the criteria was explained to them of what they needed to do to be able to be grandfathered in, the individuals indicated that they had not done it for 10 years and they may not have generated $5,000 of income, but mostly it was the time thing. And they indicated that they were just going to kind of continue to operate below the radar until they got their time in, and then they would be grandfathered in. At that time, I discussed this with Representative Kugley, or Senator Kugley, who introduced that bill. He agreed that if there's individuals that are appearing to circumvent the law long enough so they would be able to be grandfathered in, that part could be eliminated as long as his constituent would be able to continue to practice and float teeth, and that it would not have any negative repercussions on that. I've checked the Senate Counsel and the Attorney General's office, and they have both agreed that if that individual and any individual that meets the criteria when the law is in effect, they will be able to continue to do so in the future.
Well, Mr. King, that's interesting because Senator Kugley already has introduced a husbandry bill. So that seems to contradict what you just said. So,
Madam Chair, the husbandry bill that Senator Kugley and Representative Coonan introduced is... There was no discussion with the Board of Veterinary Medicine or the State Association. It was unknown to us the motivation or the rationale behind it, and I'm interested in finding out more about it.
So, Mr. King, then maybe Senator Cooley knows of other teeth floaters that are out there. And I just don't know, but I just know that there's a bill out there in the Senate, and it's Cooley is the chief author, so...
That's correct, Madam Chair. That is correct, and I have made an appointment with Senator Kubley. When I spoke with Senator Kubley a year ago when we discussed this, he did not indicate that. He did not indicate that he knew of anyone else. He did not contact the board saying that he knew of anyone else. So it's really an unknown to myself and the members of the Board of Veterinary Medicine.
Madam Chair.
Did you want to talk first, or do you want to? State your name for the committee, please.
Dr. Meg Blatley, member of the Board of Veterinary Medicine. Madam Chair and committee members, as a member of the Board of Veterinary Medicine, I'm charged with the task of protecting the public and protecting the animals of Minnesota. And all we would like would to have language in our statute so that those things can be provided for. And by having some proof of current certification for anyone that's attempting to do equine dentistry, we feel that there will be some proof that they've had some kind of formal training, and also to have some kind of supervision by a veterinarian, even if it's not on site, if it's indirect supervision. We feel that the public will be better protected by these provisions, and by removing the grandfathering clause, we can prevent people from skirting those type of training programs.
Representative Heiderkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, Representative Erdahl can relate to this with Greenleaf. If you don't have a must for some of these departments, it's not going to be done. If this says may, we've got a nursing home issue that I fought for years with the department because it didn't say must. They didn't implement law. And I think it's very important. We had a Representative Coonan did a nice job last year in the House floor arguing for this, and we had a good debate over it. I don't want to bring that discussion back up. We have Representative Coonan. Somebody wants to ask him a question. He is there, but I feel very strongly that we keep the language that we passed last year, and with Senator Kubley's blessing. I know I did an air show over at Wilmer, and Senator Kubley talked for 10 minutes in the air about this. It's very important to the senator and to the representative that the language stay as is. Thank you.
Representative Schumper.
Madam Chair, it seems to me that even if you accept this amendment and leave the language in, at this point in time, it isn't going to help anyone because, as of the passage of this Section 8 with the alternatives or requirements for certification, people would have had to, a couple years ago, start getting alternative training to continue to do this unless they had done it previously. So no one should be doing it right now without some kind of certification, it seems to me. So I don't see the advantage to anyone of leaving it in. Is there? Because they'd be violating the law if they're currently floating teeth without some kind of supervision or some kind of current certification.
Representative Heiderkin?
You're violating the law if you're caught. Right now it's me and must, and it's a big difference. I'm sorry, I work with departments. I've had problems with departments. I've had a lot of constituent problems with various departments, and I'm not saying Department of Health. But anytime you get that must-may argument, it's a big argument.
Mr. King.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not here to pick a fight. This was an action requested that the board develop this policy for protection of the public. This legislation was passed not in 2006, but 2005. It will be in effect for 2 years if this bill passed to provide for individuals that have met the grandfathering criteria to be able to meet that criteria, and they will be given just as others have been. And go forward, it will not be limited to just veterinarians floating horses' teeth. There will be non-veterinarians that will be able to float horses' teeth if they would meet some basic entry-level training to ensure competency and safety for the animals and the protection of the public.
Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to set the record straight here. you'd said, Dr. King, a couple times about this was done for an individual constituent. Well, that may or may not be true. But I was in this committee as a bunch of you were, and there was a lot of people that testified on this bill. So if it was introduced for an individual constituent, I don't know, that might be mischaracterizing it, because you yourself said you don't know for sure if there's anybody else out there that this would cover. The ink is barely dry on this issue, and it's probably something none of us wanted to get involved in again. To me, it comes down to a scope of practice and possibly a little turf war. I would say let's let the ink dry and let's let this work. I would support Representative Heidgerken's amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Junkie.
Well, Madam Chair, I concur with Representative Finstead, and for those that weren't here, and we could spend hours on this, and they had pictures and everything else we could watch, and so you'd learn what teeth floating was. It was an interesting debate a couple of years ago. I guess probably I would recommend reinstating the stricken language also at this time, and then direct that the board and Representative Shumper, you talk to the author of the bill. Unfortunately, you didn't do that, and you probably didn't know Representative Shumper, and the board, I would suggest you talk to the author from 2 years ago. If you get agreement on this, this isn't the last bill moving. I've got an omnibus bill coming out in a few weeks, and we can put it back in there. So just have a conversation with Representative Conan and Senator Kubley, and if they're okay with it, we can put it back in another omnibus bill coming through.
We can do that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it may have been interpreted that I said it was designed for one constituent. My assumption is, or my understanding is, that an individual approached his legislator, asked this legislation to be introduced, and that is the only individual that has met the criteria. Now, if there are others out there, we welcome them. The law provides for that. In addition, I met with Representative Coonan 3 weeks ago, prior to this bill being introduced in the House, and discussed this very bill and the ramifications and the impact that it may or may not have. So I believe that we did discuss it, but apparently not to the satisfaction of all the members.
Well, and Madam Chair, just to follow up. Discuss it with him. If he's okay with it, then we are too. Because we did have a long, long debate on this, as you remember, 2 years ago. And we it'll just protract the debate on the floor and everywhere else. And I think we really need to get it settled, in the committee and offices here before we go to the floor with it. So I'm just asking for some conversation again with the author. And if he's okay with it, we'll move it forward somewhere else for you.
Representative Coonan, would you like to respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I should say that the board did come and talk to me about this language, and I thought that if there would be no fight, I wouldn't be okay with it. But since then, I've heard from a lot of horse owners, and they see a big problem with this. So Senator Kubley and I have actually introduced bills now that address this issue some more. So I don't know what I'm not going to tell your committee what to do today, but there is another bill referred to this committee on the subject.
And Mr. Madam King, when we met, I was very clear that I wouldn't sign on to your bill unless that was taken out. So I think some of the rest of us were a little concerned about that. So because the ink really isn't hardly dry, and I knew that Kubley had other ideas, and so it wasn't a secret.
Madam Chair, we'll try to have some more discussion to see what we can do about it one way or another.
Thank you. Representative Heidgerken?
Yes, I thank you, Madam Chair, and I resubmit my oral amendment there to keep the language as is from 4.26, 4.29, and not have it stricken. Thank you.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment has passed. Are there any other questions or comments? Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is just a comment. I think Representative Shumper has just showed us the key to get a bill passed without discussion on the entire bill. Just throw an equine provision in there, and that'll sidetrack everybody. So, as I looked over this bill, I thought that was really the only red flag that was raised. So, I would say let's support this bill and keep it moving.
Any other questions or comments, Representative Fowles?
I remove that we pass House File 1047 as amended to the Finance Committee.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The bill has passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Representative Hansen. Representative Fowles, would you move the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 643 be passed and move to Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Mullery might want to see it.
Oh, okay.
It was there first.
Representative Hansen, what exactly is the name of his committee?
I don't know.
Judiciary Policy.
Okay, we'll look it up.
Public safety and judiciary policy.
Policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do have one little author's amendment, an oral one, to address a couple concerns I've heard from members, and it gets the bill into the shape that I would like it in. It would be on lines 1.10 after the word more and before the word employees, insert the word two words full time. If someone could move that for me.
Madam Chair.
Oh. Madam Chair, I'll move that amendment.
Full-time employees.
That full-time employees. Line 1.10.
Mr. Sullivan, can you repeat the amendment for us?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, the amendment would add the words full-time to page 1, line 10, so the new sentence would say, employer means any person or business entity having 25 or more full-time employees.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here today to speak to House File 643. I have with me Bernie Hess with the United Food and Commercial Workers, and I do have one other testifier that should be coming at some point, and then I know there are some other testifiers as well. This bill is modeled off from an executive order that Governor Johans of Nebraska initiated in the year 2000, and he has since gone on to become the USDA Secretary of Agriculture. What this does is it compiles basic rights for packing house workers and lists them in a concise area in the law for helping with educational and training opportunities to make sure that employers and employees and packing houses know their rights and responsibilities. I am handing out a report that was done. It's titled Meatpacking Industry Workers' Bill of Rights, State of Nebraska, 2005. This was compiled by Mr. Jose Santos, who is the coordinator for the physician in Nebraska. And this has a lot of data that's handed up. In 643, we call that physician ombudsman. That's, I'd be happy to change that to coordinator if anybody'd like to do that. But what the bill does is that I've made a number of amendments along the way. We have exempted employees with or employers with 25 or more full-time employees, defines the meatpacking industry, talks about right to adequate facilities, the right to adequate training, talks about information provided to the employee by the employer. It has a civil penalty, a civil action in it. That's why it's going to Representative Mullery's committee if it passes here. It establishes a position in the in the Department of Labor and Industry, meatpacking industry workers' rights ombudsman, and then it has an appropriation to pay for that ombudsman. I think the key thing, I'll just refer to Mr. Hess for a second, and then he can talk a little bit about background of the bill.
State your name for the committee, please.
Madam Chair, I'm Bernie Hess. I'm with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 789. We're out of South St. Paul, Minnesota. We represent workers in meatpacking, retail, and long-term care. We have packing facilities that we where we represent workers in Long Prairie, Minnesota, South St. Paul, and Buffalo Lake, a facility that's suspended operations right now. This bill is supported by Local 6, which is in Albert Lea, Local 9 in Austin, Minnesota, and Local 1161 in Worthington, Minnesota. This bill is about worker safety. It's about worker rights. It's also about food safety. We think it's good for the workers, good for consumers, and good for the industry. Over the years, we've been engaged in a number of organizing campaigns. We've also had a lot of stories told to us and stuff we've also witnessed firsthand about the abuse of workers. We've seen everything from a lack of drinking water in plants to bathroom facilities being locked, restroom breaks denied, and as a result, workers avoiding in the troughs in some of these operations. We also know that there is a tendency to underreport injuries, and a lot of the workers, as you know, are immigrant or newly arrived. So there's a fear about actually reporting, a fear that they might be dismissed. You know, we applaud the efforts by the industry to be safer, and this bill will merely reinforce good business practices. This bill is supported by the Worker Interfaith Network, Jewish Community Action, and other faith groups. We just think it's good public policy to support worker safety, and as a result, you'll have a safer workplace. We think the consumers will benefit, and the industry will see a reduction in injuries. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, on what says page 26 in the top right-hand corner of the Nebraska report, I think if you look at the last paragraph, it talks about a key point. With the Bill of Rights program and other voluntary partnership programs in Nebraska, OSHA's Omaha office reports over the four-year existence of the partnership, members have realized a 23% reduction in injuries and illnesses resulting in days away from work and restricted work activities. There has also been a 39% reduction in total recordable injury and illness cases resulting in restricted work. So this bill is not completely responsible for that in Nebraska, or the program, but it is part of that. And the educational and training efforts that that go on with informing people of their rights and responsibilities. The question may be, why, you know, is this duplicative? What about existing law? In fiscal year 2005, there were 49 Minnesota workplace safety and health inspectors for the entire state, not just the meatpacking industry. The meatpacking industry is according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is a difficult job. It's a difficult job. Folks get hurt. In 2005, there were 12.6 injuries per 100 workers in the meatpacking industry, compared with 6.3 injuries per 100 workers in other U.S. manufacturing. Again, in Minnesota, there are 49 workplace safety and health inspectors for the entire state. At current staffing and inspection levels, it would take Minnesota OSHA 59 years to inspect each workplace under its jurisdiction just once. not just meat packing plants, every place under its jurisdiction. So this bill compiles the rights and responsibilities, has employers and employees working together, puts it into a concise training opportunity for them. It does provide for restroom breaks, and then it provides for the ombudsman position. This bill will have to go to the Finance Committee for funding for that position. We have also handed out testimony from Stephanie Bates from the Midwest Coalition for Human Rights that talks a little about the history of Nebraska and how it can relate to here. And then if you did catch the Pioneer Press this morning, there was also a reference to the bill. There's a story on workers' death spurs charges relating to a different plant in Dakota County, not specifically a meat packing plant, but it gives some data relating to workplace injuries. And I think this bill goes a long way in trying to help reduce workplace injuries. You know, that's the overall goal. We can do a good job in Minnesota by passing the bill, compiling this material, and getting it together. I'm going to just pass around the newspaper if folks haven't had a chance to see that. And with that, I'd open to any questions. I don't see my other testifier here.
Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a slew of questions here. First one, you referenced the Nebraska Meatpackers Bill of Rights. Help me with that. I'm not completely familiar with it, but I believe it's voluntary. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, that is correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this bill is not voluntary, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, that is correct.
All right. So we're not doing the Nebraska Bill of Rights. We're doing the Minnesota Mandatory Bill of Rights. So let's, you know, just for the record, I think that should be pointed out. Second of all, this is, you know, maybe something that has to be talked about out in the open. So I'm going to ask the question. Which Minnesota companies aren't doing this? Who are the bad actors, and what's being done about it?
Mr. Hess?
Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, over the years we have observed, had reports, seen stuff in a number of packing plants. Several years ago we had an organizing drive at Dakota Premium in South St. Paul, and there were a number of abuses and things that that caused us great concern. Also, we had a drive and an organizing campaign and a contract that we arrived at Minnesota Beef in Buffalo Lake. We are currently involved in an organizing campaign down in Faribault, Minnesota at the Turkey Store. We are getting a lot of reports on injuries that are being ignored, workers not being taken care of when they're injured, and there's just a lot of abuse that goes on in the industry. It's very ironic that we're almost, I think we're at about 100 years since the book The Jungle was put out about the meatpacking industry. And the only thing that I think has changed in the number of these plants is they just move a lot faster. And what we're trying to do with this bill is educate workers about their rights. And perhaps once folks understand that and are properly trained, we can reduce the amount of injuries and make these places a lot safer to work.
Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll admit I don't know a ton about the unions, but isn't that the union's job? You're unionizing some of these plants. Isn't that your job to educate your unionized members about these different issues and then negotiate those with your union contracts?
Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, this bill is not only about workers who have a union, it's about workers that don't have a voice at work. And we believe that any worker, whether he's union or not union, has a right to a safe workplace, has a right to dignity and respect in their work site.
Madam Chair, another follow-up. And so those that are not unionized, isn't there a process in place right now? Aren't these plants regulated by OSHA and other state and federal agencies that would report these or would go after these plants for doing these things?
Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, workers in the meatpacking industry often are the newly arrived. They're not fully aware of their rights. There's an element of fear if they report injuries. OSHA is understaffed. They're not able to make it into all these plants. We finally had OSHA come into one of our plants in South St. Paul It's the first time in that I've ever even heard of it, heard of them coming in and doing a walkthrough. Yes, it is the union's duty to educate, but this is not just about our plants. It's about plants throughout the state.
Madam Chair, just then maybe to the author, a couple specific questions I have. Lines 1.18, 1.19, 1.20, and I'll give you a pass on 1.21 because it does go on to identify what this word means. But you say adequate and working restroom facilities, adequate room for meal, adequate locker facilities. What does that mean?
Madam Chair and Representative Finstead, I would refer you to Nebraska, just the book that I've handed out, and you will see the exact same type of language, adequate and working restroom facilities, adequate room for meal and restroom breaks, adequate locker facilities, adequate time for necessary restroom breaks. I think that adequate is a reasonable way of describing things that can be negotiated in contracts, but it also, I think we're talking about basic things that folks will understand where they're at.
Madam Chair, so my question becomes, we've found out now that some of these plants are unionized and some are not. So for those that are unionized, does the word adequate then become defined in the contract with the union? For those that aren't unionized, does the word adequate become defined by the state government, by the employer? I mean, to me, this seems like it's a huge gray area, that what's adequate for me and what's adequate for you can be very different. And who's going to define that? And once it's defined, who pays for those things? I mean, this is going back to the employer then, that if there's an adequate standard that someone puts onto me and say, you know, adequate vehicle transportation for your kids, and they tell me it has to be a Lexus, well, I'm going to pay for that Lexus, and I think adequate's probably a Ford Taurus, but I guess my definition gets overruled, and then I'm paying for something. So who would define those in those scenarios, the unionized and the non-unionized shops?
Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, you know, in the course of collective bargaining, we do bargain for wages, hours, and working conditions. Is this well defined? I would say that, you know, folks have common sense. We can arrive at what's adequate. I also think that you can't put a price on worker safety. You can't put a price on food safety. And this is what this bill is addressing.
Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, I think when you talk about the non-unionized shops, I would hope that the employers would work with the employees. They may often have associations or, you know, they can define those what's adequate. They have the opportunity to be providing information to their employees there. I would hope that there's communication between the employer and the employees on these type of things. Again, labor law has been there for quite a period of time. What we've done in this bill is we do cite other statutes. And that's where you see in number 4, we do talk on the code. But employers have certain rights, and the employees, I would hope that the employer would be working with the employees to provide that information in terms of what is agreed to on adequate and working restroom facilities. I think adequate and working restroom facilities, having one, is important. You know, having a restroom, having a bathroom there that you can. I think the previous existing law talked about you can have a break, but you may not have a bathroom. And so what we're talking about here is a lot of basic human dignity in terms of providing these type of employee.
Madam Chair, I have 3, and then I'll be quiet. Well, that's very subjective, what you just said. First of all, I mean, that's we can all sit here and try to play king and have put the moral language into people and say, you need to live to this standard, and we'll create that standard. And it's also very assuming, I would say. Three questions, and then I'll be quiet. Have you spoken to any of the meatpacking plants that are going to be affected by this, and what do they think?
Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, I have spoken with several lobbyists on this relating to the Agri-Growth Council and the Chamber. I know that they will speak today. In terms of specific meatpacking plants, I have not spoken with any.
All right. Two left now.
Mr. Hess.
Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, I guess I get confused at times because down in Nebraska, Hormel and IBP Tyson endorsed this bill. So have I talked personally to any of the packers? No, I have not. I just looked at what they did down in Nebraska, and they characterized it as a win-win situation for them.
Madam Chair, if I could also, I have talked with employees, and we've had very compelling testimony. I believe that a number of folks who were here have heard in other committees. We did not bring any employees to testify today, and there were at one of the previous committees employees who were not on my list of testifiers that just came forward to speak. And so I do believe it's important to listen to the employees as well and get that firsthand information, and you could check in the record in the previous committees as to what was said.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I would assume the folks in Nebraska would have supported that since it was voluntary. It'd be pretty easy to support that, I would say. Next question. It mandates here that an employer must provide an explanation in employee's native language of the employee's rights. Is that making an assumption then that there's no English being spoke? I mean, let's just put the words out there. Is that what this bill is addressing?
Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, no, that's not making an assumption. You have many languages being spoken in packing plants. If I go back to the area that I represent in South St. Paul, if you went back 50 or 60 years, you would have heard Serbian and Croatian and Slovenian and Polish spoken in the packing plant. The difference is today it's just different languages. There was English spoken in the packing plants. There was Croatian, Slovenian, Serbian. Today it's Somali, Eritrean, Hmong, Lao, Spanish, and English. We have a wide range of folks, and you probably still have Croatian, maybe some Ukrainian. There's a wide range of languages that are being spoken in the packing plants.
Madam Chair, and we could get into this debate, and I've probably taken too much time, but I would ask then those, the past that you've referenced, did they have native language explanations in all their handbooks, or is this something that they didn't do then? So, I mean, we're not comparing apples to apples.
Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, they didn't have this then, but if you go and knock on the doors, you'll find a lot of the old workers are missing their fingers or their thumbs or have the cuts on their hands. I think we could have prevented some of these injuries. That's what the bottom line is here. If you have communication and provide the opportunity for training, you can reduce some of these injuries. And I don't have any of the 70 or 80 year old workers from the South St. Paul packing plants, but Mr. Hess does represent those that are working there now and can maybe elaborate.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Finstead, I would say the big difference between plants in the 40s, 50s, and 60s and now is the tremendous amount of speed and the mechanization in the industry. We have the ability to educate workers to breach the language gap. It just makes sense to make that attempt to do it, because when I tell our retirees about some of the slaughter rates, what they're knocking down an hour in some of these plants, they don't believe me, and it's just a totally different industry. We have the resources or the ability to educate these workers. We just think it's a win-win situation for everybody around.
What's the kill on the cattle per hour versus?
Sure. Madam Chair, some of these plants have the ability to slaughter 1,200 hogs an hour now. We're looking at some plants that can do 150, maybe 100, and if I'm off a few cows, I'll apologize later, 175 cows per hour. Poultry rates are just incredibly fast also.
All right, last one. And I, again, could go on and on. as we go back and forth, it raises more questions. But there's many provisions in this bill that really raise some red flags. The last question I would have, though, are there any provisions in the bill that aren't currently covered by either state or federal standards or OSHA standards?
Madam Chair, Representative Dinstead, I believe the facilities and breaks are new, and then we also, where you see existing law, you'll see it cited. And one of the things when we met with the Department of Labor Industry was a concern that if we had existing law in another chapter and it wasn't cited, you could have potentially increased litigation because you'd have one body of law one place and one body of law another place. Again, the labor law is spread throughout the statutes. What we're trying to do here is make this a complete, concise thing that you can use for education and training of here your rights and responsibilities. So as you look through the bill, Representative Finstad, you will see where it is in existing law, it cites existing law. Where it doesn't cite existing law, then you've got new law. And we cite both the state and the federal code.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Hansen and or Mr. Hesse, is that right?
Hess,
thank you. Thank you. First of all, we all agree you cannot put a price on worker safety. You cannot put a price on food safety. You're absolutely right, and I think everybody around this table would agree with that. Everybody deserves the right to a free work, or excuse me, to a safe workplace, free of injury, et cetera, or the best that we can do, obviously. And to preserve dignity, absolutely right. We all deserve that. Representative Hansen, you made a comment about having a restroom is necessary. Not only is it necessary, it's already a law. It is a law. People need to have a restroom. People need to have adequate breaks. And if not, these are violations of current statute, current laws that are on the books. Workers' safeties, worker rights are posted in places where they can be seen, whether it's break rooms or restrooms, et cetera. And if it is not, it is a violation of current law. Am I correct with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, for many of these issues, that is correct. It is a violation of current law. But I would state what I stated before. In 2005, there were only 49 Minnesota workplace safety and health inspectors for the entire state.
Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair?
Representative Hamilton.
So it sounds like right now what we have is an enforcement issue. The laws are on the books. It's governed by the feds and or OSHA, et cetera. I mean, multiple people that govern these laws. The laws are already on the books. It is an enforcement issue. So if or when this bill passes, how is that going to be addressed? How is that going to be different? One more law on the books that's basically repetitive, but how is it going to be enforced if this is passed?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, rather than dealing with solely enforcement, I think what the law does is it provides an education and training opportunity, both for the employer and for the employees, because you've put all of their rights and responsibilities into a simple, concise area that you can use for training. In addition, it clarifies that where those laws are, and it also has an ombudsman that can work with the employer and the employees on reducing those violations. So rather than just dealing with enforcement, what this is doing is putting somebody out there, not as an enforcer, but as an ombudsman, to be working in this in the meatpacking industry to help reduce those injuries and maybe those violations. So I view this not as necessarily an enforcement, but as an education and training opportunity as well. And what we have here is we have an open appropriation that will have to go to the Finance Committee to fund that position.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, so are we led to believe then that this one more person, have one more entity, one more person out there, it's going to change everything?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, or Representative Hamilton, I don't believe it'll change everything, but I believe it can change something. And I believe that it can reduce those workplace injuries. Is it going to make the world a completely different place? No. But is it going to help reduce injuries? Could it reduce a death? I think it could by having somebody that can work with folks in their area, in their common language. I think that can help reduce those injuries.
And one final question, just follow up quick. Can I do that? All right. My final question is, in your bill, what sections are not covered by current law?
Okay. if you take a look at the bill. And it's kind of stapled on together. Subdivision 3. And then under Section 2, Subdivision 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Section 3, going back on Subdivision 4 under the first section. And then when you go into the 1, 2s, and 3s, those are cited under existing law, as are the subclauses under the...
Cited under... Sorry.
Representative,
you said those are cited under existing law?
Under the clauses under Subdivision 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then the following 1, 2, and 3 cite existing law, and it has it right attached to the clause.
Thank you.
We're supposed to be done at 9:30, okay. So what I'm going to do is...
I do have just one, my test.
But we're going to lay it over.
Okay.
Is that okay? For till Monday? There are a lot of people who want to testify yet. I think it's an important bill, and is that, that's sort of, there's a long list of testifiers, and maybe some of us can get together and work some of this out by Monday, too, and it'll go a lot faster.
Madam Chair, I move that we table this bill for now.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Committee is adjourned.